Okay, so my name is Greg, and this work was done here with Gene Carlson and Anail, who is actually now in France. So I thought I'd start out, most everybody knows what a granular material is here, but I thought I'd start out with some simple examples of the things that people do and talk about why granular materials are interesting for me at least. And so one of the first reasons is because these are big objects. So most of the experiments that people do with granular materials, you can look see the individual grains. So for example, if you want to test some sort of a theory that somebody has made up for these materials, experiments can actually go in and they can track the positions, they can track the velocities, they can even track the contact forces. And you can really test theories based on the microscopic assumptions that they use, and you can make some good progress. And not only can you track where particles are, but you can actually look inside three-dimensional flows. So this bottom example here is Jerry Golub, and what he does is he has a three-dimensional shear cell. But he has a fluid that's in there as well, and he index matches the particles with the fluid, and so he can take a two-dimensional slice of any part of his apparatus, and he can actually look at the dynamics of what's going on inside. Second off, granular material, it's the prototypical example. So they're everywhere. Bob came up with the example that $1 trillion per year is spent on handling granular materials. I've also heard that they're the second behind water in any industrial setting. So you know, if you can come up with some ideas about how they pack or how they flow, it has lots of uses. Also, they're simple, and I write relatively next to that because you can make anything as complicated as you want. But the basic idea is that you have some grains, and they interact upon contact, and they dissipate energy. And so you can include more difficult things like frictional yielding, for example, or you can include humidity effects. But basically, they interact, there's a repulsive force, and there's some dissipation. And finally, because they're big, temperature doesn't play a role, and these things are always far from equilibrium. So if you just put grains in a box, they're going to dissipate their energy and stop. And then if you start forcing the box, you're going to be putting energy in depending on how you force it, and that energy will be dissipated, and you'll come to some steady state. So these are some examples of flows that people look at. This is from Melanie Hunt at Caltech. This is a hopper flow, so there's a hole in the bottom, and the granular material falls through. And this is the case where the hopper is stationary. She does some experiments where she vibrates things. And so here, you see that the friction is highest on the wall, so it falls down the center. And then here in this movie, what she's doing is she's vibrating it horizontally. So it breaks the contacts along the sides, and it flows in down through the sides. So something that's interesting about this is it turns out that this sort of thing, when it's vibrating, it's more difficult to jam it. So you can go to smaller orifice sizes without jamming. Additionally, another thing people do is they put lots of grains on like a trampoline, and they hit the bottom of the trampoline to put in energy, and they shake around a lot. And in this case, they're in a box, and you see some sort of standing wave pattern that's been set up. And then this is my favorite example from Jerry Golub. Of course, he's looking inside again, and there's two different particle sizes. There's these big ones that he's focused on, and there's also a second size, which are the small ones that look like just the background. And he's shearing the top of this, and what you're seeing is you're seeing the big ones move to the top and the small ones move to the bottom, so there's some sort of segregation going on. And this happens over a very, very, very long time period, so that's why it's going so quickly. So what I'm going to concentrate on today is more of the shearing case, and I'm going to look for correlations. And so the question of why should we look for correlations in materials, I think this is a picture that pretty much everybody who studies granular materials has seen. It's from one of Bob Berenger's experiments, and he's shearing this from the inner wheel, and these lights that light up are the force chains that appear through the material. And you see that, I mean, the grains that are here are, you know, connected through force chains to grains that are way out here, so it seems as though there should be some sort of correlation that you can measure. But the first thing that people thought to do was to measure correlations between contact forces. So if you have a contact force at one position, and you have a contact force at another position, they should be correlated in some way. But when people measured this in flowing systems and jam systems, they always found very, very short-range correlations. So like one or two particle diameters, it died out very quickly. Recently, Bob Berenger has been able to find a sort of averaged contact force that he can find correlations in. And we're going to look for the correlations in flowing materials. And everything that I'm going to be doing today are simulations that we're doing here, and simulations of shear flows. So here's the basic outline for the talk. I'm going to start out just giving a background of what brought us to this point. I'm going to talk about the numerical algorithm we use, And I'm going to talk about some research on kinetic theory that we were doing that first led us to think about correlation links and how this might be important to describe constitutive relations in flows. And so then I'll talk about the correlation length measurement and how it affects contact force distributions, constitutive relations, and SGC theory. So. And this is the material that we simulate. We use a special trick so we can do shear flows without any sort of boundaries. It's a common trick. We have the grains are made up of lots of different sizes. They're over a range, and we just shear the thing. And in this picture, the green that you're seeing is just the force chains that pop up whenever there's a force. I draw them green. So this is what you should think of whenever you see any data. And we're always going to look at steady state properties of this.
What is your trick?
Lees Edwards boundary conditions, and there's this SLLOD just to start it up. And so it's the common trick that everybody uses. If we remove the SLLOD, it'll remain stable. It'll start a shear flow by itself. The SLLOD starts it off with a constant shear profile. That's all that it does. Yeah, maintaining volume, and we're prescribing the shear rate. So this is very different than what people do in real experiments or other simulations too. Well, we measure the stresses on the boundaries by looking at the individual stresses on grains from the contact forces. So there's the common way that people determine stresses from contact forces, and that's what we do. So basically, yeah, we set gamma dot. I'll talk about this more. But we set gamma dot, which is the shear rate, where there's a constant volume, and then we measure shear stresses and pressures. And so since there's a constant volume, there's also a constant density. So in what I'm going to be talking about, you'll see a lot of dependencies on density. So that's what our variable is.
How do you take energy out?
So maybe I'll just move to the next slide and talk about the actual algorithm that we use. Looks like it's trying to move. Okay, there it goes. So the actual algorithm that we use is a rather new algorithm. It's called contact dynamics. So this was first developed about in the early 80s, and it was developed as a way to understand the properties of buildings. So you want to imagine buildings that are made up of bricks or something, and how they're going to change with time. And so it kind of got hijacked by the granular physics community. And so the idea is we want to treat grains as perfectly hard spheres. So what that means is that we're not going to introduce any sort of time scale into the interaction. And so the way that we take energy out, we take it out from the normal components. Every time we have a contact, so let's say we move the simulation forward some time step, and we have contacts between some number of grains that form some sort of connected cluster. And so these contacts, they won't be perfect. There'll be a little bit of overlap depending on the step size that we use. But for each one of these contacts, what we do is there's a rule to take away the energy. We say that in the normal direction, we say that the final relative velocity is equal to the initial relative velocity times some constant, which is a restitution coefficient. So we take energy away from this restitution coefficient in the normal direction, and then in the tangential direction, we do the same thing to determine a force. And then we have an extra constraint that the force in the tangential direction has to be less than or equal to some Coulomb friction coefficient times the normal force. So using these three relations, you can determine the forces in any sort of cluster that comes up during your simulations. And that's exactly what we do. And the benefit to this is that it introduces no time scale. And the way that it does that is it basically says that the speed that information is propagated through the network is infinite. So the idea is if you have a contact here, there's going to be some rule. It's going to look like this of how we're going to take energy out of this contact. But in order to determine what the force is going to be from this rule in Newton's equations, you have to know what's happening all the way over at this contact. So it sets up a sort of non-local force propagation through these networks. And really, I mean, I guess it's that the wave speed is infinite. So that's what this hard sphere limit corresponds to. And we're always going to do homogeneous shear flows. And these are independent variables. There's the normal restitution, the tangential restitution. There's this friction coefficient, the packing fraction, and there's the shear rate, gamma dot. And for most of all what I'm going to talk about today, I'm going to consider just frictionless flows. And so these two variables aren't going to matter for me. And since there's no time scale introduced by the interaction, gamma dot is the only time scale in the problem. So this can be scaled out. So for example, if we're looking at something like pressure, we can scale it by the square of the shear rate, and that's going to hold for all values of the shear rate. So the two main independent variables are going to be the restitution, which says how much energy we're taking out per contact, and this density, packing fraction.
Do you include the rigid body rotation?
In the case that there's friction. So in the case that there's friction, this first constraint tells us that we're just going to be rolling along our contacts. And then depending on what the frictional force maximum is, you can get some sliding as well. But in these frictionless cases that I'm going to be talking about, and the reason I'm talking about them is because the theories that we're looking at, especially kinetic theory, is really tailored towards frictionless materials in the very dilute limit. So that's the main motivation, and we're going to build on that. And I think it might become clear to some of you that lots of the things that we measure don't so much depend on what the exact values of the friction are. It just depends on whether there's enough dissipation occurring. So when there's a lot of dissipation occurring, it doesn't really matter so much whether it's occurring through these degrees of freedom or those degrees of freedom. It's just important that it's occurring for the things that we're going to be talking about.
Yeah, so. Non-trivial coefficients of restitution.
Yes, and not friction, yeah.
That's a really, there's a brand of things. What I think of contact dynamics is contact morphology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's.
And who I think was really creative. And so what I would say is really your invention is more like inventive.
Except the difference is, okay, so there's other simulation methods. Whenever I talk about this contact dynamics, it's not the first thing that people think of to simulate granular flows with. So I like to explain why exactly we're doing this. So there's also event-driven simulations. So in these simulations, there's these exact same dynamical rules concerning the normal velocities and the tangential velocities. But the difference is that you only consider binary collisions. So what you do is you have your simulation, you start it out, you say, at what time is the next contact going to occur? And you move forward to that time. You have one contact occurring between two grains. You resolve that contact, and then you move on. So there's only ever binary collisions that are occurring. In the contact dynamics algorithm, we have a set time step. So we can have cluster interactions that happen. So the problem with event-driven simulations, they work very well for like hard sphere fluids that are elastic. But one of the early things that was discovered about granular materials is that once you put in a coefficient of restitution less than one, what you start seeing is you start seeing clusters that form in your material. So this is a simulation done in the early 90s with a lot of grains. There's something like 40,000 in there. And so you can't make out the individual ones, but they're the little black dots. And so the idea is, any time you have a binary collision between grains in this algorithm, the velocity, the normal velocity, is reduced. So there's a tendency for the energy decreases, and there's a tendency for things to clump together. So if you run this long enough, you get these. This isn't the case when you're not shearing, by the way. But if you run these long enough, you get these little clusters that are forming, and you get something called inelastic collapse. So formally, that means that there's an infinite number of collisions in a finite amount of time, so you can't move your simulation up anymore. So there's a fundamental limit to how far you can simulate hard spheres using this event-driven simulation. So the other way that people characterize simulations of granular materials is by using cluster simulations, or I guess DEM, another way that they call it. And so they add another thing called the stiffness. And so the stiffness is something that tells you it has to do with the modulus of the grains, and so it tells you how much they can deform. And so a unitless measurement of the stiffness is just some value. This tells you what the Young's modulus is, for example. You divide it by the shear rate squared, in our case, to non-dimensionalize it. And recently, there's been some investigations into this sort of a soft shear simulation with simple shear flow, so exactly what we're going to be looking at now. And so this is work done by Campbell and recently by DeCruz. And so the idea is that they have a constant volume simple shear flow, and they turn it on with some value of stiffness. And then they ask, okay, if we keep increasing the stiffness, do we reach a limit where the results no longer depend on the stiffness? And what they find out is that there's some sort of a critical density, and I drew it as a box here because the exact value is sketchy. But there's a critical density, and if you're below this critical density, you can always increase the stiffness enough to where you can just consider your system is made up of perfectly hard spheres. Above this critical density, the results always seem to depend on what kappa is. And so down here, we're going to call these inertial or hard spheres flows, since they just scale with gamma dot. And up here, these are the quasi-static flows, which depend on the stiffness, or some might say the jamming transition, which also depends on what your stiffness is. And so if you want to look at this range of densities or packing fractions, the event-driven simulations can simulate hard spheres down here, but there's some cutoff density where they can no longer do it. This contact dynamics algorithm can really simulate the whole region of where you have inertial flows. So the first question that you need to ask yourself is, well, you have these event-driven things, and they assume binary collisions, and there's some cutoff density. But if you use these other simulation methods, there is no cutoff density. You can go a lot higher in packing fraction, and you can still have these hard sphere flows. So the question is, the first question is, you know, what is this binary collision assumption, and is it really relevant to what we want to study?
If you diagrammed it here, would you argue that you use a contact dynamics for flowing
fraction? No. So this arrow should stop before here. So there's no, well, you know, this is a question. This is I think different people will have different opinions.
Because others have used it.
Yeah, others have used it to talk about quasi-static flows. But there is no stiffness in these simulations. You can introduce a stiffness by not characterizing your network well enough. So there's some error cutoffs that you can use in this algorithm that can sometimes mimic a stiffness, but there's no real stiffness, I don't think. And so I think that the best regime to use these things is in this inertial regime, but that's definitely an opinion.
Could you say something about what becomes pathological in contact dynamics algorithms as you approach the
critical density? Yeah, so the thing that becomes pathological for me is that, so it's really a difficult problem that these things solve. So the idea is you have some cluster that forms, right? And so this is a small one. It can be a lot larger, right? It can contain thousands of grains, right? And so at each contact, if we forget the friction part, at each contact you have some sort of constraints. And so you want to simultaneously solve all of these constraints by determining what the force is are between all of the grains. And so what ends up happening is as you increase the density, you come to a regime where you just keep searching for those forces and you can never find them. And so it seems to me that that's because you need an extra degree of freedom from the stiffness, but...
So is that a function of the fact that you're treating each particle independently instead of trying to invert for an equilibrium surface?
Well, it's not treating each one independently. And the way that you can see that is, let's just look at this one, this one, and this one. So there's a contact here, and there's a contact here. So when I'm resolving this contact and I want to determine what the force is, I know what the final velocity is going to be, but the force is going to depend on the motion of these things. So I know what the relative final velocity is. So, you know, the final velocity of this one in this normal direction minus this one. But the force that I determine from there is also going to depend on the force from here, which is telling me how far this guy is going to be going, what the final velocity of this guy is going to be. I think I explained that poorly.
Doesn't it get much worse when you take into account the friction?
It gets, yeah.
There you've got this bound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does get, and we'll see.
It's history dependent and you have no history because it's instantaneous.
Yeah, and we'll see these problems coming up with the friction as well. And I mean, you do run into more problems with friction.
And the example you gave of the soft sphere simulation, did that include friction? That
was a frictionless case, but I mean, they can definitely include friction. So, yeah, there's the question of what...
But it might be a different question as to whether the approach of the infinite stiffness limit...
Yeah, that's definitely true. That's definitely true. Where this is might be a totally different question, yeah. But the question that I'm going to be talking about in this talk is this box the same as a box that we could put down here that tells us when binary collisions stop being important? And so, I mean, this is, you know, a lot wider range.
It's important for me and some others to understand what contact dynamics is really
do. Okay.
I've got a collection of parts to you. But they're not all really saying ultimate contact.
Yes.
At the same time.
Well, so, strictly speaking, no. So in the algorithm...
So what are you actually doing in the algorithm?
Okay, so in the algorithm, we start with a collection. We have some velocities and positions. We move forward a certain time step. And then after we move forward that certain time step, there's going to be lots of grains that penetrate. And there's also going to be grains that are just coming into contact. So everything that's penetrating or just coming into contact, we're going to say that's a contact.
So you're going to define contact.
Penetration.
Penetration.
And then there's some rule for determining the final velocities and therefore the forces.
A finite
forward time step. You figure out where everybody thinks he or she ought to be, and then you figure out some approximation where everybody is going to be later on.
Yeah. And obviously the approximation gets better as you lower the time step. But the idea is that you can't have this time step just be event-driven and just consider binary collisions, because you run into this problem of inelastic collapse. So it seems like...
One comment about that, which people have with...
Yeah, we're playing around candy from the party.
Yeah. Save some for me.
They gave us the candy so it would be even worse than the next doctor.
People claim to regularize to get rid of the collapse problem.
An event-driven, yeah.
By making resolution coefficient go to 1 as the collision velocity goes to 0, which is not unusable for, say, viscoelastic particles like class 0 or class 2. Presumably that's true. So I think that the actual range on that kind of EV model can get up a lot higher.
Yeah.
So, people like sitting and stuff do that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I think it might be a little unfair to those people to say that it's such a, of course, you don't have a scale on the picture, but hard to say, but I think, that kind of thing does.
Yeah, so, I should say, we're just doing constant restitution here. It's actually something that I'm confused about, because I've seen experimental studies where they claim both. So they claim that the restitution coefficient climbs up to 1 as the velocity becomes smaller, and that is what lots of other models predict. But then there's also experiments done that have a flat coefficient of restitution going up to small velocities. So, I'm confused about what the right interpretation is. And
Well, I think that the best experimental studies of restitution,
and that was constant, right?
The other thing is that prediction for viscoelastic behavior is speed to the 1/5 power.
Okay.
So if you're doing even a careful experiment, you might not detect such a weak variation. Technically, the problem may be resolved. Can you determine experimentally a problem with it?
Okay, so maybe we should say for this presentation, we're always going to be constant restitution, and this might be or might not be what's really happening, and this is one way to regulate this constant restitution at high packing fraction.
I just comment on a question that actually is for everybody here. The work that you cite by Campbell, it's been criticized by a number of people.
Okay.
Because he doesn't have
this. Yeah.
And he uses this soft sphere method. And then calculates for an assembly without any friction, calculates coefficient of restitution for the large volume, and then makes these arguments about where you are in the inertial domain and where you're in the frictional domain. And it seems to me that there's so many parameters missing in the experiment. In the simulation, is where the difference between simulations and experiments is important. He was asked in some talks that I attended whether he'd done any experiments to test any of his values here, and he has no data on that. And so it always
for including friction?
Concerned me a little bit.
What's that?
For including friction, you mean?
He has no data to validate whether his results were in fact, whether his simulations were in fact consistent with
thermal data. Oh, yeah. That's true.
So I always wondered about that.
I think you raise an important question. So especially from a geophysicist's point of view, how realistic is this sort of an algorithm, when you don't add friction? And I think, from that point of view, it's not realistic at all. But from another point of view where, if we include friction, we have an extra 2 parameters. So let's take that out for a second, and let's see what things we can say with just a normal coefficient of restitution. And you can't take that out, because if you do, you'll have this penetration of things. So this is necessary to have any sort of granular flow, and then so is this in realistic flows. But let's take this out, this friction, and we can still simulate things. And let's talk about simple theories that just talk about frictionless grains, and let's see if we can extend them and come up with analytical models where we can describe things. And so I think that's what our method has been. And the problem with that, of course, is that we're not considering realistic things per se, but we're trying to make some theoretical advances, I guess. It's hard. including friction is really hard, as everybody knows. So.
Getting rid of it.
Yeah.
So we're...
Please.
You've answered it and I've started to talk. Why is clustering a bad thing?
It's not a bad thing. It's not a good thing.
So clustering is collapse. Ah, where you get a similarity.
Yeah.
It doesn't represent earthquakes.
Wait a minute. So I mean, in this inertial regime, the best theory that has come out is kinetic theory, and this is assuming binary collisions, and so that's where we started at with this line of research. And I mean, it's very well developed for frictionless hard sphere systems. So we're going to look at frictionless hard sphere systems. And kinetic theory is based on basically three major assumptions. There's some sort of collision rule that they assume. This is how energy is dissipated. They make the binary collision assumption, and then they assume molecular chaos. So the collision rule is just something that looks like this, exactly what we're considering in our simulations. It's a simplified way to take out the energy. Binary collisions means what you expect it to mean. And then this molecular chaos is basically the idea that if you have two grains that are coming into a binary collision, their velocities are uncorrelated. So this helps kinetic theorists do the integrals that they need to do, basically. Whoop. And so, yeah, we basically came up with some simple ways to test both of these assumptions. And so, for example, for the binary collisions, you can test the assumption by measuring stress tensors. So the normal way to measure a stress tensor sigma, and I'm calling it the static one because it depends on the forces, is by summing over all contacts in the material and looking at the force times the distance between the grains. This is the normal way to determine the stress tensor. So if you just have binary collisions, or if you assume that only binary collisions are important in your material, you should be able to change this force into the force that would be experienced by a binary collision. So this is, if you have a binary collision and you conserve momentum and energy is dissipated according to this rule, you can determine exactly what the force should be. So you get some other expression, which depends on the restitution coefficient in the normal direction and the relative velocities in the normal direction. And it's also divided by our time step. So whenever we determine a force in our algorithm, since we have a constant time step, we're always determining an impulse divided by the time step. And so in this case, we have the same thing. We have an impulse, which is the relative velocity times the mass, which I didn't write down for some reason, divided by the time step. So this is just a really simple way to measure whether binary collisions are really important. And the other thing with the molecular chaos assumption is you can measure pre-collisional velocity correlations. And since this is the highest order approximation assumption of kinetic theory, you can say, well, do the predictions of kinetic theory match? So we've done both of these. I'm not going to concentrate on this one today. Lots of people are thinking about this in the literature. Lots of people are testing molecular chaos and trying to incorporate velocity correlations. But I'm going to test this binary collision thing today and talk about that. So basically, we can look at the ratio of these stress tensors by looking at the ratio of the pressure or the ratio of the shear stress. And so when we do that, we get, this is the ratio of the pressures, the total to the collisional and the shear stresses. And it's for lots of restitution coefficients as a function of packing fractions. So if you look at the high restitution coefficients, it's equal to 1, it's equal to 1, it's equal to 1, and then it pops up. And then if you look for lower restitution coefficients, it's never really equal to 1 for any values of the packing fraction. So this is just a simple macroscopic test of, well, what's going on? There's some sort of problem with this binary collision assumption. So this historically, and that's what I'm talking about, it brought us to the idea of, well, we should be able to see some sort of microscopic violation of this binary collision assumption. We know that in the dilute regime, we have these little clusters that form, but there's only binary collisions going on. And as we go to the quasi-static regime, we have these large force chains that form that span the whole material. And the question is, what happens in between? Can we really characterize the clusters that we find? Because I mean, there has to be some sort of route from here to here. It doesn't seem plausible that it just happens discontinuously. So the first thing that we looked at were these sorts of pictures. So what I've done in these pictures is you take all of the grains in the simulation and you color in the ones that have contacted in the last some number of time steps. And if it belongs to a separate contact network, you color it a different color. So for low density or high restitution, so this is close to the inelastic I mean, the elastic regime where no energy is dissipated, you see that it's mostly binary and it's well spaced, but as you increase your density or lower your restitution, you start seeing these big clusters that form. And so... this?
Yeah.
Oh, that's packing fraction. So actually, from here to here, in this case, I've just lowered E. So nu is about 0.79. And this is restitution of 0.92. And this is restitution of 0.5.
Same nu?
Same nu, yeah. So the idea is you can increase the chance to clustering by increasing the density or decreasing the packing fraction. By increasing the density, it kind of makes sense to you because you think you're packing more stuff in, so they have to contact. But by lowering the restitution coefficient, the idea is when there's a collision, they tend to be closer afterwards, so you have more density fluctuations and a higher local density. So,
what's the color coding?
It's just different networks that are forming. So if you look at this guy that's purple, all of these are in the same network. So this guy is connected to this one, and that sort of thing. I haven't done three-dimensional.
These are all two-dimensional.
This two-dimensional.
Sometimes I ask you what new is and you give me a number, but until I know where I am, all bets are off, and by going through the system, you shift around the gem.
By changing the size of your system.
By changing the distribution of the parts. So if I have a monitoring system, the gems,
okay.
Gem plus packs, but if I sort of do the magic.
Can I hold off until later about that? Because it's difficult to determine exactly where it comes, but it'll come in a second.
So these networks are in contact at all times, or are they bouncing back and forth between each other as the time step equals to your time step?
So it depends. Some of them are in contact for multiple time steps. Some of them aren't. These clusters are just things that have contact in the last X number of steps. Yeah, so I don't think you should think of these as either things that are bouncing around or things that are in constant contact. We'll come to measurements of things that might be in constant contact later. But this is just the first thing that we looked at just to get an idea. And the problem with this sort of a measurement is, I mean, the size of these clusters depends on how many time steps you use to calculate them, so on and so forth. So the contact dynamics isn't good at giving you a cluster size. It's good at giving you a cluster frequency, a contact frequency. So, but we remember, I mean, I remember sitting in Gene's office and looking at these pictures, you know, and being like, well, you know, there's got to be some way to measure the fact that this is showing up. And so this is what brought us to think about correlations. And the thing that we settled on is measuring spatial force correlations. So the idea is that if you have two grains at Ri and Rj that are separated by some distance L, you consider them and you take the dot product of the total forces. So each grain has some total vector sum force, and you take the dot product, and you see if this correlation function is non-zero for large distances, since the grains only interact on contact, the idea is that there's some sort of network in between them that's causing them to be correlated. And so this is a sample measurement of the sort of thing that we see for high density and low restitution coefficient. We see some ugly oscillation oscillation at low values of L, and then we have this long slow decay. And I'm normalizing here by the average grain diameter. And what gets interesting when you plot the log of these things, and you see for three densities, so packing fractions, so for 0.6, that's these red ones, 0.77 is these green ones, and 0.81 are these light blue ones that you might not be able to see very well.
So this is the total force of a given particle from all of these, therefore equal to acceleration.
Yeah, so it's acceleration correlations.
These are sort of co-moving.
Well, so
correlation of co-accelerating.
Yeah, co-accelerating. So people measure velocity correlations, this is another common correlation measurement in granular flows. And you can get velocity correlations when there's no contact between two grains. And so, for example, in event-driven simulations where you just consider binary collisions, if you have a collision, the collision rule makes it so that grains are more moving like this after the collision than they were before. So just this this energy dissipation at contact can create velocity correlations when you just don't have a network at all. But so these acceleration correlations, really, you need some sort of intervening network, we think, to produce them.
But would never capture what the kinematic parameters would expect.
Which are static, yes. So this is another question. So this stuff applies for inertial flows. And so the question is, what happens when you cross over to quasi-static flows? I mean, additionally, we see exponentials and we don't see powerless. So this is another interesting thing. So.
What are these funny oscillations from? Because they seem to be very well resolved.
Yeah.
It's not scatter.
No, it's not scatter. And I, you know, when you look at, for example, you know, one of the places to look for oscillations is in G of R, so the probability to have two grains at some distance apart. And I'm sorry, I didn't bring a picture of our G of R, but there's very, very little structure in our G of R beyond 2 grain diameters or 3 grain diameters. So, I mean, the question of where this is coming from, I'm still stumped. Maybe somebody else has an idea.
I understand
what
it's worth.
Huh?
That is 2 or 3 grain
diameters. Well, you know, right about there is 2 or 3. So, I mean, and also in G of R, there's like, there's just a little bump. It seems very insignificant when you look at it.
Radii or?
So it's oh, diameter, yeah. So if anybody has any ideas, you know.
Well, hey. It's like a train track, right?
Uh-huh.
What would you know, you've got, and you push one end of the car, right?
Uh-huh.
This one's going to have, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Going to hit another one, which is
going
to give it
the opposite force,
which is going to hit the next
one,
which is not. I see. Do you think it can just be that simple an
explanation? It would be fun to look into that.
It doesn't require anything to do
with
the
GLI. Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
I think. It produces the same thing with the TEM.
Oh, yeah?
It's kind of
when you look at this same measurement? Or.
Well, our
oh, she could. Yeah, that would be.
Of course, it might take that long for it to.
Oh, I see. So it's like.
So this is the train wreck.
The train wreck, yes.
Really, by a lot of. If I was doing. If I was doing a DC experiment, then again, there's a sort of plot here. But I have force bound everywhere.
Mm.
And that means where I'm going to end up having correlations in certain directions. But if I push this way, then I have, sort of, if you like, structures that are supporting the force, then
mm-hmm.
they make the structures to go forever. Mm-hmm. So you end up with a longer effective correlation than in force than you'd ever hope to see in position.
Yeah, I see.
But this is non-directional?
No, it's directional. I'll get to that later. So this is just initial. We're looking over all directions in the flow. And yeah, so we get some sort of exponential. It turns out, you know, especially when you go to low densities, measuring exactly, it's noisy. And so, I mean, as you get to low densities, it's difficult to really characterize what the exponential decay is. So we wanted to look for some sort of a measure where we could throw something into a function and determine what this correlation length is, xi, that's here. And so, I don't know if anybody can see this, we came up with this simple little expression. It looks like an average value, but it's not. And it turns out that, I mean, so these black lines were plotted using this measurement for chi, and it turns out that it tells you what the slope of these things are very well. So it's just the measurement used to determine chi from the correlation measurement. And you do this for lots of different things, lots of different densities and packing fractions, and this is the sort of plot that you get. This is just a blow up of the high density things, but this is as a function of packing fraction, the length scale divided by the average diameter, as a function of lots of different restitution coefficients. It's flat for high restitution all the way up to a pretty high density. To answer Bob's question, I mean, here, this is the highest packing fraction that we've been able to look at. And the reason is because to do these constant volume things, you have to pack them in the box first. So that's the most we can pack in the box. I don't know if that's a jamming transition, but if I would bet, it would be between 0.84 and 0.85. Just because 0.85 is ridiculous to try to get the algorithm to pack in the spheres. The two interesting things, well, there's lots of interesting things, but two of these is that it diverges at large packing fraction. And this is, I guess, to be expected. If you imagine having a shear flow and you want it to jam, you're going to need some sort of correlation that percolates to the system. That's going to be a necessary condition. before it can jam. And so this the place where it diverges doesn't necessarily tell you what the jamming transition value is, but it's close. And then the other interesting thing is that it comes down to some value that's not equal to 1. And so I'm going to call that Xi elastic, because this is the value that you would expect in the elastic limit where you just have binary collisions. And the reason that it's not equal to 1, I think, is just because, you know, I have a polydispersed system and grains of all different radii are bouncing together. And so this is just some average that comes out when you just consider binary collisions. So that's going to depend on what your grain distribution is. And I've done some simulations for other grain distributions and it changes. So it's some value. Most everything that I'll talk about now, I'll talk about Xi divided by this value.
Have you looked at the time correlation?
Yeah. I've looked and I haven't been able to see any. I mean, you know, it's really noisy and it definitely doesn't have any sort of long range character like these things do. So at one instant of one time step. So
but then if you look at the force and then at a later time, so
yeah, I don't see anything between different time correlations of the same force or different forces. So if you look at the at one grain, at the force on it as a function of time, I don't see any correlation. Or if you look at different grains as a function of time, I don't really see any correlation.
You'd expect that the lifetime of these clusters
Maybe I should look closer. I mean, that's so, yeah, because you'll get a time scale from that, yeah. That might be interesting. I mean, another explanation might be that there's a wide range of timescales, but I don't know.
The force-force function, at least in the Gordian, can relate to the viscosity. If you measure the total shear force required to maintain your flow, is that something you've monitored as you approach the same transition?
No, so spatial force-force correlations are related to stress? The time, right?
You just look at the total stress in the system. Does that also diverge as you approach this?
Yeah, I should have brought that, but yeah,
that's
basically
proportional to viscosity.
Yeah.
And then there are these microscopic relations for the viscosity in terms of force-force correlation.
Oh, really?
In equilibrium.
Oh, in equilibrium. Well, that might be interesting to look at. Maybe I should. Yeah. Yeah, because I mean, definitely we see the pressure, the shear stress, the granular temperature all diverge at this, or look like they're going to diverge at, you know, same value about. Yeah. So this is all.
And that's maintained no matter how dense.
Yeah, always maintained. We've tested that to some ridiculous order of magnitude. So. So the slide with friction, it's kind of pitiful. But so if you, these are all at restitution of zero, just because that's what we did. It was large correlations. And so this is zero friction, which you saw in the last case. This is friction of 0.2 between grains and 0.4. So as you increase friction, the place where it diverges seems to, the packing fraction where it diverges seems to become lower. And this suggests, you know, that maybe jamming occurs quicker for at lower packing fractions for frictional materials. But of course, this is just a necessary condition, so it's just interesting to look. Then there's the question of the anisotropy of these things. Instead of measuring the correlations without regard to the orientation of the pair, we also measured them with regard to the orientation. We found that for each angle bin that we looked at, there was an exponential decay again. So in each angle bin, you can determine a length scale in the exact same way that we determine a length scale for the isotropic case. And so if you plot the length scale in these polar plots, this is for zero restitution coefficient. And so the small one is for 0.7, and then it increases to 0.79. Something that's interesting about these graphs is that, I mean, the angle here is always about, you know, 135 degrees. And this is despite the fact that other anisotropies, like, for example, the average force is a function of angle, and the probability to have a contact is a function of angle, they all depend. So, I mean, as you're going from 0.7 to 0.9, you know, if you're looking at the average force, it's going to do something like this. So it's going to change. Also, if you look at, for example, the principal axes of the stress tensor, they change. as a function of what your density is. So they're not staying quite as constant. So this is a mystery. I do know of one paper by Christine Herenia. How do you say? Herenia. And she has done event-driven simulations, these constant restitutions, and she's looking at inelastic collapse. And she noticed that when inelastic collapse starts to occur, it always occurs between grains that are oriented 135 degrees. So this is something that's interesting in that it seems to be a dynamical property as opposed, you know, that comes from the shear rate and the way that we're shearing things as opposed to something that comes from the stress sensor. But I'm not exactly sure. And the data is also noisy. So in this plot, I've looked at... It's difficult to get these for these sorts of plots for systems with small correlation lengths. And the reason is because in those systems, there's very few contacts in this direction. And so there's a lot of noise here. Even for these high-density ones, there's a lot of noise here. And so, but if you take the correlation length as a function of angle and you divide it by the average correlation length, the data looks to relatively collapse, although there is a lot of error. And it's well fit by this sort of a function, which is the same sort of a function that people use to fit force anisotropies and whatnot. So this is something interesting that we're still looking into and don't really understand. So that's all good. There's some sort of correlation length that comes. It has to do with the size of networks in your material. It tells you about how kinetic theory is breaking down, but you know, what are you going to do with that now? And can you really come up with new ideas for how to describe the flow or come up with new phenomena based on this idea of correlation length? So this is the picture that I want to start thinking about. I imagine that I have two grains that are contacting. So I'm going to consider these two grains, and I know that there's some sort of a force between them. So the force is composed of not only the force that comes from their velocities. So this is the binary collision force. If it was just these two without any of the network around it, you'd have some sort of force between them. So that's part of the contribution to the force. But there's other contributions, too, that come in. So for example, because this grain is here, it's pushing on this grain and creating a force, which is being transmitted up here. Similarly, since there's this grain and this grain in contact, there's a force that's transmitted through here and up to this contact. And because we're in the hard sphere limit, all of this transmission happens instantaneously in our simulation. So the idea is, you know, this is the new idea for, you know, how to think of flows between the binary collision regime and the quasi-static regime. So the first thing that you notice from this sort of a picture is that, well, depending on the size of your contact network, the nature of the force distribution that you see between grains should be totally different. Because in the case where you just have a binary collision, it just depends on the velocities. But in the case where you have, you know, this network, it depends on all these other forces from different grains. So you expect that you might see some sort of signature in the contact force distribution function. So these contact force distributions, I think they're one of the most well-studied things in granular materials, at least from a microscopic point of view. But I saw that you guys talked about this on Friday, and you talked mostly about the large force behavior. And so originally it was seen to be exponential, and then for shear flows. And then people noticed, well, if you compress these things a lot, you start to see that they look Gaussian. So I'm not going to talk so much about the large force character. I'm going to talk about the small forces, and in particular this idea that came out a few years ago that the jamming transition is or the emergence of a yield stress is characterized by a probability at low forces going from some sort of a dip to having a peak. So the idea is that if you're below the jamming transition or not quite quasi-static, you have this peak at zero forces, and then it's monotonically decreasing. Whereas once you jam and have a yield stress, you have this hump that comes up. So this was observed in simulations of granular flows, simulations of foam, simulations of glassy materials, and it was suggested that it might be a universal characteristic of the jamming transition. So, however, you know, recently people do other things, and so in particular Ferguson and in 2004, they were looking at hopper flow of granular materials, and they were using event-driven simulations, and they saw something totally different. They saw for high speeds out of the hopper, they saw this solid line, which has a nice peak, and as they reduced the size of the hopper outlet, they saw that the peak kept going up and up and looked like it was going to start to disappear. So this may then suggest the opposite, that the peak disappears as you go to the jamming transition. And some people thought that that might just be because of the event-driven simulations, but recently Gary Grest has done this with DEM simulations, and he's found the same thing. So this question of what's going on here is really something that can be addressed with this correlation link. And this is what we find. This is the log of the contact force distribution for a constant density, a constant Packing fraction. What I'm doing from the bottom up is I have high restitution to low restitution and the corresponding values of the length scale next to it. And so what we see, if the length scale is very small, we see a hump. It's very obvious. And the large scale here looks kind of Gaussian. That comes from the velocities. I'll talk about that later. But as you increase the length scale, the hump disappears and you get something that looks like it just has a maximum at zero. And another interesting thing is once these length scales get large, the form doesn't really seem to matter that much. So the idea is that down here we have binary collisions between grains. We have some sort of average velocity, which is also the most likely relative velocity to have, and that's what causes the hump. As you move up here and you start to create a network, you have lots of grains that are at rest relative to each other, which create small forces, and then you have lots of forces transmitting through the network, which create these long forces. So, and we also see this for constant restitution. Here we're at restitution 0.75, and we're increasing the packing fraction, and we see the same sort of a thing. The good thing about this set of data is that there's a peak here and there's no peak here, and it occurs within a very small range of the length scale. So something to propose is this value of the length scale for the transition when you start seeing this sort of a feature.
I'm puzzled by these plots because you're showing probability of forces over the average force. So it seems that if I were to calculate cumulative forces,
oh, sorry, yeah, I've just offset these. I'm sorry, I didn't say that. So the same with these ones earlier. Just so we can see all of them, because, for example, these top three would be right on top of each other. And so, yeah, I've just moved them up.
Maybe another thought here is that the P of S that you're thinking of in terms are always the same. Right?
Yeah.
And it's less clear what that might impact into you, and particularly about correlations, which presumably are induced by the dynamic aspect.
Mm, yeah. So you're talking about which...
So you go back to RPA. Yeah.
So this data was... I mean, for this data, they had some quasi-static flows as well. I mean, they were looking at flows, I thought.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, the question is, do you see the same distributions for, say, the dynamic system versus the static system? And so if you compare it to our shear... static PFS, they don't have to level.
Okay.
So for instance, it did, but at low F, that you were showing for example, Landry's, it's very, very strong in shear flows, and basically not nearly so strong in our.
I see. So this might be a dynamical effect. Yeah.
It could be a dynamical signature that no one knows what is.
Yeah, it seems. I mean, it seems the thing that I was going to suggest is. I mean, it seems. So here they discuss in the paper, Ferguson. They discuss the reason that this increases as you decrease the flow rate is they suggest velocity correlations are coming into play, but they're always in this regime where you just have binary collisions. So, I mean, it seems natural to suggest that this is a dynamical transition, and it's occurring because you're creating networks here. And so when you go from something that has a hump to something that doesn't have a hump as you increase the density, this is because you're going into a regime where networks are important. And so this might be a characteristic for something like that, and it's definitely something that we see from our simulations.
But there's still finite networks.
Still finite networks, exactly. So the question is, as you keep going up here, what happens, right? And in particular, I mean, what everybody here is interested in is what happens when you go way up and you get these very large correlation lengths, and, you know, yeah, that I can't answer. Our systems never develop yield stress, so can't really answer what happens up there. But for these ones with the small correlation length, the obvious thing to do is, you know, reduce the force distributions to velocity distributions. And the way to do this, I mean, if you just have binary collisions, you have some force that goes like the relative velocity, The circles are the force distribution considering just the measured force from the simulation, and the line is by considering the relative velocity. So in this regime where you're below 1.25 about, you have everything determined from the velocities, and it can be determined from kinetic theory. But the question is, how do you start to treat these things in the dense regime? And this is something that I've been really interested in. And how do you start to discuss what the force between these two grains should be as a function of all the other ones? And so the way it seems to me like you should go about doing this is you have this force between grains I and j, which are the blue ones, and there's the contribution from just their relative velocities. And then there's also a contribution from all these different paths through your material, which in the hard sphere limit go instantaneously. So a simple way to break these things down is into paths of length 1, length 2, and length 3, and you write it as a sum over some function of the path length. And I just wrote some equations, but I'm not going to discuss them much. The idea is, so for a path of length 1, that's the idea from here to here, there's some force between A and J, which is this force. It's propagated through, and then the amount of that force that results in pushing on here has to do with the dot product of this unit vector with this unit vector. So you can write an expression for what the extra contribution from these different path lengths should be, and you can do it for as many path lengths as you want. For length 2, you have some force that starts out here, and then the important vectors are the dot product between here and here. That tells you how hard it's pushing there. That's this first term, and then you have another one, the dot product between this and this, which tells you how hard it's pushing on here. So another one. So, it's hopeless to try to look at these things, with the full forces and try to find a probability distribution function, but something that's simpler to do is to think about the pressure. So the pressure in our simulations, so it's the trace of the stress tensor, it's the distance between grains times the force, and in our simulations, there's very little correlation between the size of the force and the distance between the grains, so this is true to within about 1%. So the pressure is related to the average contact force. So the static pressure over the collisional pressure is related to this ratio of forces. So in the last equation, if you just take an average value, you get the average value of F is the average collisional force plus the average of these path forces over the average cluster size. And you can actually determine what these averages should be. And once you do that, you get this sort of a relationship. So this is between the static pressure and the collisional pressure, where G is some function of your average coordination length and a constant that is unknown at this point. And we can determine this constant just by some simple ideas. So if we take limits, in the dilute limit, the average coordination goes to 1. That's binary collisions. And there's no length scale. The length scale is the elastic one. So the static pressure is the collisional pressure. That makes sense. In the jamming limit, the idea is that these grains stop moving relative to each other. So this collisional pressure should go to 0, which means this side diverges. But the only way to make the right side diverge is to have the correlation length diverge, which is something that we expected. It should be a necessary condition. But there's another condition that the average coordination is greater than some value. So this is another thing that people expect. In order to have a system jam, you need to have a certain number of contacts in order to create force balance. So in D dimensions, it goes like 1 plus D. So this gives us a value for alpha. So this is a simple model. And now that we have this value of alpha, we can measure Z, we've measured chi, and we can xi, this length scale, and we can measure all these pressures. And it turns out, this simple idea works surprisingly well. So what we've done here is we've plotted the left-hand side of this equation just with data from our simulations versus the right-hand side of the equation on a log-log plot. And then this line is the line y equals x. And you see that the data for lots of different restitution coefficients seems to collapse, and it seems to be well characterized by this function. So this is something that's interesting to test in the future further, I guess.
If you were halfway sure you fell along, and suddenly you contracted one side and then you turned it to the original state, so you were generating acoustic pulse through the shear layer, what would you see on the side that you hadn't contracted?
That I hadn't contracted, yeah. So I'm thinking.
So you're looking at them. So I might imagine, yes, so your rule says your contact force has to
propagate instantaneously.
But in actual fact, I have this nagging feeling that there's kind of a correlational effect. And so you, if you did some sort of average pressure at the far side, you might actually see an acoustic pulse, which is then representative of information propagation through the system.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that's... So in a real granular material, I definitely agree with you. I mean, if you push up on the bottom, it's going to take some time for this thing to propagate. And the idea is, you know, there's some finite stiffness and there's some wave that's set up, right?
And that speed typically is lower than...
Lower than
what people would think if you had a bunch of contact sitting there.
Okay, I see. So there's an extra effect from the anisotropy of the network. Yeah, I mean, I think that this result is very special to the sorts of simulations that we're doing, for example. And I don't know the answer to your question because I haven't done it. But yeah, I mean, I've tried to think of some ways to, you know, generalize this idea that there's some sort of correlation moving through the network that's formed to software systems, at least in terms of simulations. And I have some ideas, but I don't think they're, you know, well enough developed to talk about now. I think basically the idea is I think that this has to be replaced by something else. And the thing that the new length scale that becomes important, at least the very high densities, has to do with the wave sound in the system and the length the contacts are in contact with each other, so this time that they're in contact. But this is just for these things, and I mean, try to think of ways to extend it later. And I guess I'm running... Well, there's a few things about STZ theory that I was going to talk about. The idea is that once we move away from just the pressure and think about something like the shear stress, things get ugly because everything starts to depend on the nature of the clusters that are forming. It depends on how these things are contacting, what all the orientation is, and everything. You can't just get away with thinking of averages. And so... Well, I mean, since we did some research on the STZ theory, the first thing I thought of when I was looking at these correlation lengths was how is this going to affect STZ theory? And I think the answer that I came up with is it's not going to at all. I think that the idea of the... Maybe I can talk about it really quick. So for people who don't know STZ theory, the idea is that there's non-affine motion and it happens in certain regions in your material. And this is the classic... Well, this is the old picture of what the idea is. You have some arrangement that changes, and that's what allows your system to shear. And so the question is are the regions that are correlated with their forces the same as the regions that undergo these shear deformations? And I think the answer is no. But a necessary condition is that you have these clusters before you can start having things that rearrange. So that's the only way that these correlations really come into play. And something that we've measured, this is just the equations that come into it. But the prediction for hard sphere granular materials in STZ theory, there's a well-founded prediction, and you can plot... Sorry, this sigma should be an S. No, that's right. That's the average diameter. I'm sorry. So you can plot the stress over pressure as a function of this average diameter times the shear rate over the square root of the granular temperature. And so for lots of different restitution coefficients, everything lies pretty much on the STZ curve. But there's these pesky ones that don't really lie on the STZ curve. And it turns out that these are the ones that have cluster sizes smaller than 1.25. So the idea is that they're not even in a place yet where they've created these clusters, so there's no way that there can be any rearrangement yet. So this is another reason why maybe this 1.25 is important. But so that's about it. We can measure correlations and to quantify these force networks, the size of them, at least in the hard spheres. They play a key role in constitutive modeling. They tell you when kinetic theory stops to work. You can make some simple pressure models in the hard sphere limit, and they have a little bit to do with STZ theory. And, you know, if somebody is doing some vibrated bed experiments, they can maybe measure these probability distribution functions and see if there's the same behavior from a peak to no peak. And I guess this is the new picture that I think people should have, and I don't think it's going to be hard to convince you guys that this is the way it should be, but there's lots of people who think that this box where the binary collision assumption breaks down is on top of this box where the system goes from inertial to quasi-static flows, and this is for constant restitution, of course. And so I think the idea is that there's kinetic theory down here, there's theories of quasi-static flow up here, and so we need something to connect the middle, and I think that's an important research goal for people to have. So. Thank you.
So you showed us that sort of the force vectors are anti-correlated if you go along the wave. Have you looked at the orientation of the force vectors? Do they sort of
Well, we've looked at this together at one time, right? Yeah, and so the idea was Craig and I... So Craig did a lot of measurements of these velocity correlations once you have this these transformations happening. So we used his code to look at the force correlations, and they weren't as obviously correlated when we looked at that. You know, there weren't these vortices setting up like there were in these velocity correlation cases. So I think this is an average measurement over lots of time steps, and it takes quite a bit of to make the exponential decay come out well. It takes quite a bit of data in the steady state. So I don't think they're like those, but you can't. I mean, not with your eyes, you can't see them.
I mean, thinking about Mark sort of the box prime, that you would think the force vectors would sort of be aligned along the clusters that you hear. Is that your gut reaction or something?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the scale of these things, it's another important feature, I think. So if you look at the scale, this is normalized by the average square of the forces, and I mean, this is 10 to the minus 1, 10 to the minus 2, and that's true for all of the different densities that we look at. So I don't think it's something that you'd be able to see so well if you're looking at a single picture, because, you know, I mean, what were your correlations when you looked at velocities? I mean, the size. Were they of order 1, or, I mean...
Yeah,
so it seems like, you know, I mean, these might be lost when you're looking at it. But, I mean, I like the boxcar idea. It's interesting.
Suppose that I would ask you the following question. So you're doing your acceleration... If I were to do it with probably different, but suppose I were to just ask what is the mean of the magnitude of a contact force compared to already, I assume when you normalize by F squared, you're talking about the net force on particle as well.
Yeah.
So your correlation function starts from a, let's say, pretty low, and gets lower. Suppose I were now just to ask the question, what is F magnitude average, like, you know, what are the contact
the average squared,
and ask how big is the mean of the contact force compared to this
compared to the correlation.
I mean, it's sort of a question of how big is your load compared to
how large is the correlation.
And it does seem like that's also a piece of the
I seem to remember. Yeah, this is something I should look at. I mean, I don't want to say anything that's wrong. I mean,
so actually, for instance, there are systems changing the mean load has a non-trivial effect on the problem.
Okay. Which is, they disappear? Well, no. What?
Well, as you increase the pressure on your system, you tend to destroy the probably longer probably.
Okay. So these are the compression experiments. Okay, yeah, I mean...
And it's not big, it's not like you have to put on, you know, 10% deformation to reduce the correlation a lot.
Okay. So see, I mean, this is hearsay, but I mean, the sort of picture that I see is that, I mean, it seems like there's some sort of a divergence here, and if you're thinking about some sort of soft-sphere system, it seems like it's going to level off somewhere. And then, so what you're telling me is, I mean, as you compress the system more, it seems like the density is going to increase. So if we're thinking in terms of density, we imagine these things coming up, hitting a maximum, and then coming back down. Maybe.
You think it's critical?
Yeah.
Well, but I think once you have soft-sphere, then time becomes relevant. And so it still diverge in the zero limit, but in finite
zero,
you see non-Newtonian that we really have to extract it.
Yeah.
Do you have to change your time step as you approach this point? Do you have to show the time step?
Have to, we do. I mean, so down here it doesn't make sense to use the small time steps that we use way up here. You know, we're up here we use a shear step of 10 to the minus 6, and we've been able to increase that to 10 to the minus 5 and we don't see a difference. If we increase it to 10 to the minus 4, we start to see a difference. And so, I mean, 10 to the minus 6 is good and 10 to the minus 7 gives the same. So, I mean, it's... I assume that, you know, this is 0.84, so this... I mean, so the idea with these correlation measurements is, I guess this is the best graph to look at it. So if you look at this point and then you look at the next one, 0.82, it's much bigger than any of the system sizes that we can look at. So we can't get correlation lengths for this material. But if you're down here, you can go all the way up to 0.84, and I'm telling you that 0.85 is something that doesn't seem like we can simulate. So I think that if we wanted to keep going up really close to where this jamming limit's at, we would have to start decreasing it a lot. Or I think we would start seeing something that looks like elasticity in the simulations, and other people have. If you have a too small of a time step, or if you don't resolve your contacts well enough, then you have some sort of elasticity that propagates. So, I mean, these results we've been able to determine don't depend on our time step. So, (laughs)